This is the Parliament Hillbillies, episode 11, for June 19th, 2006.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know what the honourable member has been smoking or taking. The fact is...
Welcome to the Parliament Hillbillies, your podcast for Canadian politics. I'm Alex.
And I'm Jerry. You can check us out online, phbo.blogspot.com. Any comments or questions about today's show, just leave them on the blog or you can find our email address.
So, I guess it's been a little bit of a break that we've been on the last, I guess, just over a month now that since our last episode. And, you know, we're busy guys, like, these days for some reason, so we haven't gotten around to, like, doing a show, but we finally, like, sat ourselves down. And so I think today what we're going to do is try to, like, go back over the last, like, month, you know, some of the things we want to talk about. Instead of just talking about the most recent, like, this week's occurrences, we'll try to catch up with some of the topics.
Yeah, so also the dog days of summer, like, contribute to our laziness.
I call it the summer stink.
Yeah, summer slump. Anyways, yeah, we're going to go right back.
You know, when you get out of bed at 3 o'clock, you know, you stay up until 6 in the morning, like, that kind of
yeah.
thing.
I know all about that this week. Yeah, I guess where we left off last time was we were talking about the vote for the Afghanistan extension. And so we'll talk about how that turned out. We'll check in with the Liberal leadership race. Always lots of fun stuff going on there. And one of the fun things, of course, is Joe Volpe and some of his campaign donations. We'll briefly talk about Gwen Morgan, Stephen Harper's appointee to the Integrity Commissioner. And of course, the big news is the potential terrorist attack that was thwarted by several arrests by the Ontario Provincial Police, and now
in conjunction with the RCMP and CSIS, and basically every major police force in Canada, I think, was involved in that bust. And then, of course, you know, we got a couple of good parliamentary quotes for you this week. But first, you know, we'll take a comment from one of our listeners, Justin the Wiccanator. He writes on our website concerning last episode and the explanation I gave about the concept of Creative Commons and his feedback on that. He says, concerning describing Creative Commons as a hippie community, I irk at that explanation, even though I'm a bit of a hippie myself. Are Creative Commons people communists too? Most of the world hates these ideologies, and it's important to make people aware that Creative Commons isn't anti-commercial or anti-capitalist. It's just a different model for artists to make money. And, I should say that, I think that's a very fair assessment, and, we want to, try to promote Creative Commons, and, I don't want to give the wrong idea about it. I guess the intent of my explanation, referring it to it as like a hippie community, was the idea that the mentality of hippiness is really conveys two points. One is the rejection of an authoritative status quo, and the other is the spirit of liberalism. And I think that both of those really fit the bill with Creative Commons. And he is right; it is a sort of a legal model for artists to make money in a sort of a more free way. Or distribute their content, but still have it protected under law. Obviously, it's not communist because that ideology is really associated with taking away personal freedoms, whereas Creative Commons is kind of like a stark contrast to that, by granting personal freedoms of what you can do with content. So,
yeah, it's not communist, it's communist. Actually, I've heard self-described. It's like sort of a play on words, but C-O-M-M-O-N-I-S-T.
Yeah.
A play on commons from Creative Commons.
So, in this case, the pinnacle of 19th century political reasoning and the biggest failure of the 20th century in terms of politics, that's definitely not what we're, we want to dissociate ourselves from that. Because really, this is the pinnacle of 21st century thinking. So, hopefully there's going to be a way forward with that.
I don't know if I call it political failure, but I mean, it's still alive and well in certain parts of the countries, like certain countries around the world.
But well, apparently you...
It has failed in certain obvious large implementations of it, but still going strong in other places. So,
I wouldn't agree, but that's a topic for another show. So, yeah.
All right. Why don't we play some quotes?
Yeah, okay.
So tell the listeners what tonight is, if they don't already know.
Oh, wow. You know, Stanley Cup Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals. I watched, Jared and I both watched Game 6 on Saturday, and that was really, really, like, that was a feel-good game. And, you know, everyone was getting into the, like, crazy spirit, you know, Don Cherry.
Yeah, Don Cherry's suits, like, get progressively more gaudy as the, like, series goes on. So I'm tuning in tonight explicitly to see what kind of a suit he's going to have on.
The key is to wear a suit with the plaid, the line spacing of the plaid to be at the right diffraction frequency to cause, like, your monitor to erupt with, like... You know, like, beat frequency, you know, kind of... Anyways, but, no, it's going to be really exciting tonight. And, you know, this whole, like, hockey spirit has been a little overshadowed by the World Cup, which it's been a bit of a surprise to me. You know, the CBC, like, has taken the last week to talk about the World Cup and basically give almost no attention to the Oilers. And I kind of resent that because I felt like they really wrote the Oilers off. And, you know, clearly they, you know, have, you know, earned their place in Game 7. So, you know... I mean, not to take anything away from the World Cup. I just think that, you know, Canada really is a hockey-first country. I don't think too many people would disagree with that. So, you know, if you want to talk about the World Cup, you know, just get the, you know, get the NHL, you know, story done and out of the way and then go on, you know, to the rest instead of, you know. But anyways, the spirit of hockey has been dominating the parliament in the last couple of weeks, and we have some ridiculous hockey-like themed questions from question period that we want to play for you.
Yeah, so take her away.
Mr. Speaker, tonight the Edmonton Oilers will be playing in Carolina in the opening game of the Stanley Cup Championship Series. This is the first time since 1990 that the Oilers have made the finals. Since 1993, when the Liberals came into office... No Canadian team has won the cup.
Shame!
We can see the change in government is already having impact. Can the Prime Minister tell us if the government has any position on the Stanley Cup Finals?
I'm not convinced that even if the government had a position, it would be something that's within the administrative responsibility of the government, which questions are supposed to deal with. So I think, with great respect, all right, we'll hear from the Prime Minister very briefly.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I just want to observe that every step of the way, the Edmonton Oilers have overcome injury and adversity to go from eighth place to the finals. They defeated the President's Trophy winner, the Detroit Red Wings. They battled back against the San Jose Sharks and the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim. And if they continue to play the game they're capable of playing, they will bring the Stanley Cup back to Canada, where it rightfully belongs.
Now, that was a question from a conservative backbencher to the government. And, you know, the whole question is stupid. Obviously, the last Canadian team to win the Stanley Cup was the Montreal Canadiens in 1993, and technically that was during Kim Campbell's administration during the summer of 93, and Chrétien came in November of 93. So technically there were no Canadian teams that won the Stanley Cup. But that's what he said regarding the Liberals. But then he also said, you know, well, clearly our government has, you know, is making a difference, but... all that has happened is that the Oilers have made it to the finals. Well, the last Stanley Cup, the Calgary Flames made it to the finals under the Liberals. So, you know, the whole...
Well, hopefully tonight that the premise of that question will be valid.
That, man... yeah, so anyways.
But anyways, the next quote we have is an exchange between Stephen Harper and leader of the opposition, Bill Graham.
From the next day.
Yeah, from the next day. And so I just cut out the main body of the question, but it was just thrown in at the end. So.
This is just another example of, like, the playoffs gripping the question period. And, you know, I don't know. It's all in good fun, but at the same time, listen to this.
And he must be careful to give an answer in the House
which is more responsive than his answer yesterday about the Oilers, Mr. Speaker, which seemed to have jinxed them in their game last night.
I will predict, Mr. Speaker, it won't be difficult to exceed the Stanley Cup record of this government, which didn't win a single Stanley Cup for Canada in 13 years.
We know he's a big fan of hockey, and so that's no surprise. He's a hockey, writing a book on
hockey historian, and yeah, so
all that good stuff.
And you know, he was on Coach's Corner on Game 6 on Saturday, and you know, gave a really good assessment of the hockey game. And you know, they were interviewing him. They're like, "Oh, you know, what does the Oilers team need to do to win tonight?" And he's like, "Well, they just got to keep going shooting for the net, you know, just taking shots on the net, and that's what's really important." And you know, they did that. They, you know, the Oilers stopped going after the perfect play and just tried to get it into the net, and it paid off. And so hopefully, they'll be able to recreate that victory tonight.
Yeah, I hate to bring it up, but Bill Graham has a little bit of a point with jinxing, because if you remember, before the tournament actually started, or the playoffs started, Stephen Harper's two picks were the Calgary Flames and the Ottawa Senators. Wasn't the Edmonton Oilers, and both of those teams got
eliminated.
Yeah, out of the Canadian teams. And,
yeah,
and he didn't obviously pick Montreal either too much.
But his diplomatic answer to the, like, Radio Canada, like, you know, reporters, why he didn't pick Montreal, his diplomatic answer was, you know, well, you know, Montreal has always been known to surprise us, kind of thing, you know.
But they didn't surprise us.
Unfortunately not. But, you know, I have a theory that says that the NHL doesn't have any interest in letting any Canadian teams win the Stanley Cup except once in a blue moon, because, you know, you don't need Stanley Cups to keep the Canadians into the NHL, but you do need Stanley Cups going to the United States to keep the American market into. And at the end of the day, this franchise is very heavily dominated by money. And so, you know, the money's really what I think is, you know, talking here. I don't know what's going to happen tonight, but I mean, I hope I'm wrong. So.
Yeah. Anyway, continuing with the hockey spirit in the House of Commons, another favorite tactic of hockey fans is the chant, and the chant has made itself into question period, and we have a couple clips.
Pleased to report to the Houses, the member probably knows that, in fact, the unemployment rate in Canada has not been this low since 1974, that we've had tremendous
members, this is not a hockey game. The Minister of Finance has the floor, not skating. The Honorable Parliament Secretary, the Minister of Public Works and Government Services. Order.
About this file, of course, there's been a lot of speculation.
So that gives you a little taste for the spirit of the Parliament as it is right now. Now, we got two more chants for you, but we need to set these ones up. So, Jeremy.
Yeah, so what happened here is that we have Joe Volpe, one of the people running for the Liberal leadership, and Mr. Volpe decided to take some campaign donations, and they were kindly supplied to him by a CEO of a biotech firm. Now, the companies themselves can't give money to the campaigns, and so what happened was the CEO, you know, he gave the maximum amount, which is a couple thousand dollars.
The personal allowance for...
Right, right, and then his wife gave the personal allowance maximum. But then his kids, who are like, I don't know how old they are, probably like 8 and 10, they gave the maximum amount as well. So we have these kids that are, you know, raiding their piggy banks for thousands of dollars. And
tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, like, tens of thousands of dollars and giving it to Joe Volpe.
And this became known.
Right. And so since then, Joe Volpe has given the money back. But, you know, he said he was within the rules and all of that. So, you know, the letter of the law, yeah, maybe he's okay. But the spirit of the law, definitely not. But well, anyway, this is Stephen Harper taking a couple jabs at Mr. Volpe's expense.
There's also a qualitative difference, Mr. Speaker. This government believes that the government should support the children of this country. Watching the Liberal leadership race, they think the children should be supporting the politicians.
Wednesday, but we have to have some order. This is question period. It's not a hockey game. The honorable member for Kitchener Center has the floor.
By the way, Mr. Speaker, that's $1,200 for every child, not $5,400 from every child.
Well, anyway, you get the point.
Anyway, this next quote comes from Rona Ambrose, our Minister of the Environment. And all along she's been saying that, you know, we can't meet our Kyoto targets for emission reductions. But she seems to, at least if you read in between what she says, she seems to say something different here.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the truth of the matter is that thanks to the Liberal government being in power for 13 years, the Bush government has done more on the environment than this country has for the last decade. They're outperforming us on pollution control. They're outperforming us on emission reduction. Mr. Speaker, this government is going to make sure that we outperform not just the Americans, but all of our counterparts.
Now, if you listen closely, she says that the United States, they're outperforming us on emission reductions. And we're not going to just beat the United States. We're also going to beat all our foreign counterparts. Now, who the foreign counterparts are, you know, who knows? But I would say that the next logical one would, of course, be Britain. That's the second country that we're closest to. And if you know anything about Britain's environmental plans, they're not just on target to meet their Kyoto targets. They're going to, like, double what they have to do. And so if we're going to beat Britain, then we're clearly going to, you know, meet our Kyoto targets with lots to spare. And so she's been saying all along that there's no way that we can meet our Kyoto targets. You know, it's going to bankrupt the country. And now she's saying, oh yeah, we're going to beat all our foreign counterparts. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. Either we're going to beat them or we're not. And either we're going to meet Kyoto or we're not.
I think that we're not. And I think that's the word, you know.
So. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. But as long as the Conservatives are in, I'm sure we won't.
Won't what?
Won't meet the Kyoto targets because it's not a priority to them. But we may meet them if the Liberals come in. Now, whether or not that will bankrupt the country, that's another question. But it's certainly a hot topic that's being debated in the Liberal leadership debate. There's a lot going on about the environment. And Michael Ignatieff, who's sort of the front runner, he brought up this idea of carbon tax. And the next day in question period, you know, the Conservatives were all, you know, dissing up the carbon tax. And so it's very clear that he's a front runner because, you know, not only is he getting ganged up in these leadership debates from the other people running, he's also being ganged up on by the Conservative government, who seems to have pinned him as the target that they have to quell.
Now, well, I got a question for you. Here's my question. If global warming is a consensus that has been arrived upon by all of the academics of our country,
I don't think anyone believes that all academics. I mean, there's clearly like a minority report of academics. But
okay.
The idea of a consensus is that, you know, there's
this
a super majority.
Okay. If that is true, if there is truly a consensus of academics in Canada, then why are the research dollars that are being spent on global warming going up?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I mean,
they're probably looking at, yeah, solutions. I don't know. You tell me. Like, I haven't heard that they.
I'm just throwing it out there. I personally think that it's just going to show that I mean, see, the problem is the science is not as well developed as everyone seems to, you know, be stating in the media that it is. You know, 9 out of 10 scientists agree. I mean, agree on what? I mean, it is the single most complicated realm of science that exists today.
But there's also an idea of science converging upon a solution. And so, you know, they may not know precisely how it's going to come down, but they may be making forecasts that are, in general, like, probabilistic.
No.
And so you have to put more research in to become more and more accurate.
Here's my question to you.
To me, personally? Yeah.
To you, the listener, and, you know, Jeremy, you're listening to me right now, so you're a listener. Mathematically, like,
okay,
you're part of the set of listeners.
Giver.
If you cannot rely on the 7-day forecast to predict the weather, within you know, any sort of, you know, generally acceptable confidence, then how do you rely on long term over the next 100-year forecasts for the entire world?
Right. Well, I would answer that two ways. One is, you mentioned confidence intervals, and that's important, like, when you're keeping in mind with global warming. The second thing, well, I would ask you, you know, how come you can't tell me what Ford stock is going to do in the next 5 minutes, but you can tell me basically what it's going to do in the next 4 years? Right? It's a chaotic system. It's fluctuating randomly, but there is a general long-term trend. Right? So you can say that with reasonable accuracy that, you know, it's going to grow by a certain percent over the long term, but that doesn't mean you can keep track of the minute-to-minute fluctuations.
Well, I mean,
not that I'm saying they're exactly the same. I mean, I'm not a climatologist, but I know it's a chaos system, and when I think of chaos theory, the stock market's kind of like the first.
So what you're saying is that there's short-term disorder but long-term order.
Yeah.
And I don't agree with that.
Okay, that's fine, because I'm not saying it as an authority.
I mean, climate models, like any chaotic system, are, you know, they have this fractal quality to them, which says that the structure, whatever structure is there, is present at all scales. And so the randomness is present at all scales. And so what it's going to do at any given point, I mean, when you say, oh, well, we're predicting that Ford will do X, and then, you know, 5 years from now, Ford goes bankrupt because they're, you know, doing a crap job in the market right now, you know.
Yeah, Ford was just an example. But, I mean, that's basically what a mutual fund is. I mean, it's they're buying stocks that are relatively stable. They have a pretty good idea. Now, it's more complicated because they're hedging their stocks, so you're getting a diversified group of stocks, and they're diversified in their industry such that if one stock goes up, the other one will go down just because of the relationship of the two companies within industry. And so it's, you know, it's not the perfect analogy, but I would suggest that that's a possibility.
Yeah. I mean, I would argue, however, that the stock market is complex, but the atmosphere is far, far more complex than the stock market, because, I mean, the stock market has a human factor there that is a lot better understood than the human factor in the climate model.
Right. Well, I mean, they had these charts of what the global temperature... Now, we can get in debate about whether you can, you know, do such a thing as take, you know, the average temperature of,
right.
of
and you
a continuous system.
And you can't,
but you can sample it at regular intervals and then take an average of the samples.
Yeah. And that's completely meaningless, but...
Well, I wouldn't say it's meaningless because,
yeah.
I mean, right now we're recording in digital, right? So they're taking samples, and we can say what the average volume of this podcast is, and that means something.
Yeah, but apples and oranges. You know, a temperature is not like a height. You know, you take all the students' physical height dimension in a class and you average them together. Well, that means something. And you have an averaging function that says, in the case of height, you choose an averaging function that says, I'm going to sum all the heights and divide them by the number of students. But there are different averaging functions for different occasions. Like, for example, voltage, you use, you know, root mean square.
Right.
Because that has the basis in the physical property. But a temperature is a field, not a quantity. So what's the averaging function for a temperature field?
Right, okay, so maybe average is the wrong word, but you can measure its deviation from its previous values. And the idea but just wait, first of all, to address the idea of the field is that you sample the field. So it's continuous, but you take samples at regular intervals through time and space. And whether or not you
can
do
that. You're taking discrete samples in a highly complex dynamical system where what happens at position X versus what happens at position X plus, you know, epsilon are different. You know, you have a coffee cup and a
But they're different.
Cup of ice sitting beside each other. You know,
they're different, but they're correlated, right? And so, I mean, you could have situations like that where you have like something really hot and something really cold side by side. But in general, you know, you hope that the average, it averages out, like, across multiple samples.
Yeah. The thing is, like, from a Newtonian standpoint, that makes a lot of sense, right? See, here's the point.
Anyway, okay, but just let me say that, you know how they have these graphs of, you know, the Earth's temperature over the last, you know,
the hockey stick graph
or whatever,
with the little hockey stick hook at the end.
You don't accept that graph at all? You completely disagree with it, or
completely disagree with what?
That represents like anything of meaning.
Well, what are we talking about here?
Well, because that graph has structure, and that's my point. It has a long-term structure.
Right. So you can sample something that doesn't have any meaning, and it will have structure, you know, potentially.
Right. So you're saying that graph is meaningless. That's just my question to you. Like, I'm putting
Which graph are we talking about?
The hockey stick graph. The graph of the global temperature over time.
Well, I'm saying I have a problem with the fundamental concept of a global temperature.
Yeah,
so if you want to make a graph of something that makes no sense,
and then
say that it has, well, it's the graph is not meaningless. It is a graph that represents a number that has been constructed called a global temperature.
It's meaningless in terms of reality. There's no correlation to reality of that graph.
Of the hockey stick graph.
Yes.
Well, you know, there's some arguments that have been put out about what's wrong with it, namely, you know, what does it mean to have a global temperature? I mean, how can you measure that?
Right. So you're not answering the question. You're like as bad as like the MPs in Question Period.
Well,
I learned you on our new feature, which is Question Period Jeopardy. Where
man,
we play
I learned
the answer
I learned from the best, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, listening to Question Period too much, you learn how to make evasive answers.
The point is that. It's a very, very simple physical axiom that you can't have a global temperature and have it mean anything. You can you can sample something and you can take those numbers and add them together and divide them by the number of samples and then say, I got a number. But what does that number mean?
Right. And so what that number means is that at those sample points...
Right.
You know, that's what the average measure that you took.
You're averaging something that you can't take an average of it. It's just a very, like, I mean, it's just a physical perversion. It's like a physical fallacy to average something, you know, to perform a mathematical operation on something. It's like doing integer arithmetic on finite field elements. They're two different creatures. So, you know, you can do that, but it doesn't mean anything within the scope of what you think you're doing.
Right.
And that's, I'm just saying that there are some people that have been sucked into the romantic image of a global temperature. But
I'm not going to say I agree or disagree with you. I'm going to say I really don't understand what you're talking about. But I'm sure that it's, like, not of much interest to our viewers. So maybe we can take this discussion
Well, I think
offline.
The global warming is a... very interesting topic, but, you know...
Sure. I mean, the nitty-gritties of whether or not you can average temperature. Unless if you want to continue. But.
Well, I hope to have a research paper that I can, you know, read for you in the next few months that's going to get published on the topic, so...
All right. I think I might know the source of that research.
You may well know the source of the topic, but anyways.
Anyways, Alex, our resident global warming skeptic. Thank you. Okay, do you want to talk about... what do you want to talk about?
Well...
All right,
I haven't been following a lot of these topics.
Okay, let's hit it up. Okay, last week, you did an episode alone, and... last month, more than a month ago. It was on the eve of a big vote, I think it was the eve, of an extension to the Afghanistan mission... And you talked a bit about how the vote went down, and, you know, I had some issues with it, which I emailed to you. But that's water under the bridge now. The point that I want to make is how did it go down? So basically, the Bloc and the NDP voted against it. The Conservatives voted for it. And then the Liberals held a free vote on the issue. And so it really split the party up along certain lines. And so you have Bill Graham, who's the leader of the opposition. He also was... Minister of National Defense, and, you know, he played a big role in Afghanistan. He voted for it. You have Ujjal Dosanjh, who voted against it, and he's a critic for National Defense. And so all through, like, Question Period the last weeks, every time he asks a question, you know, Gordon O'Connor gets up and he's like, that member doesn't know anything about the military because he voted against the military. He hates the military, you know, and just... It doesn't make any sense. But anyway, the point that I wanted to make was if we look at the leadership candidates, They also were split on the issue. And so basically the majority of them voted against them, and the only ones that voted for it was Scott Bryson and Michael Ignatieff. And also Michael Ignatieff, of his supporters within the Liberal Party, the MPs that are supporting his bid for leadership, you know, that block, you know, pretty much voted for it as well. And so when the vote was done, you know, Stephen Harper walked over across the floor and shook, you know, Michael Ignatieff's hand, because he recognized that, like, without him and his supporters, that it probably wouldn't have gone through, because it was very close. But
I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I think that the Liberals recognized that, I think strategically they probably wanted it to continue, but they wanted to be seen as, like, objecting to it. So what they did is they made sure that they had just enough objectors to not throw the vote. So that they could be seen as, like, taking a stance when really they knew that it would go in a certain direction.
Yeah, it could have been coordinated. It's hard to say.
Not necessarily coordinated right down to the member, but...
Right. I don't know. I'm not sure that it would have really hurt the Liberal Party if it hadn't.
Because think about it, when you have votes, right, and, you know, you have a party that says, you know, just say the bloc's like, I'm gonna vote in favor, then the Liberals can, you know, vote however they want, pretty much, because they know that it's going to go through. So then they're just like, well, you know, we're just going to make a stand and vote against it, even though, like, if the Bloc had come out and said, we're not going to go vote in favor, they probably would themselves vote in favor, you know, sort of thing. So it's sort of like having a sense of what other people are going to do then affecting how you yourself do it, kind of thing.
Right, that could be. But they're also the party that is really on the dividing line. I mean, the Bloc, like in Quebec, it's very unpopular war. The NDP, a lot of NDP supporters are very against the war, especially because we're under, I guess are we under NATO? I'm not sure. I believe we are fighting under the banner of NATO. And so, you know, they're against the sort of American element of it. And then the Liberals, though, they brought us into the war. And so there are supporters in the party, but then there's also detractors, too. So I think it was sort of a natural split along the parties. And, you know, the two sort of most right-wing candidates, perhaps, in the Liberal leadership voted for it, and then, you know, the more left-wings voted against it. And I might also add that, of course, Bob Rae and Gerard Kennedy aren't MPs, but they both made statements saying that if they were MPs, that they would have voted against it as well. So, anyway, you saw the Liberal leadership. Did you have any, like, comments on it?
Are you talking about the debate over the weekend?
There was a debate on Saturday. There was two debates. One was on Saturday.
No, I just caught the sort of the commentary in the paper afterwards, and a couple of, like, sound bites on, you know, CBC afterwards. And basically, you know, it just looked like a totally bankrupt, you know, sort of just, you know, our platform is we hate Stephen Harper and everything he stands for, kind of thing. So, vote for Liberals. We hate Stephen Harper. Well, you know, if that's, like, all you got, then, you know.
Yeah, I would say that's an oversimplification. But, I mean, there definitely
You're right. That it's probably an oversimplification based on the digest of the actual events into the media.
Right.
Because, you know. Like, it was Father's Day, you know, I was hanging out with my pappy, came up to visit, you know, me here in Ottawa and stuff, so I honestly had no time for the Liberals, and so, you know, I just had to catch the you know, commentator's reaction to it, and that was basically the impression I got, was they had nothing constructive to say.
Yeah, well, yeah, I watched it, I was, like, kind of baking, and I had it on CPAC, like, in the background. And so
you were baking? Or you were baked?
I was baking.
Okay. Was that those cookies that we had?
Yeah, actually, they were.
Oh, yeah. Jeremy made some fabulous chocolate chip cookies that we had before we started recording.
Domestic house husband. Not a husband or a house husband, for the record.
Yeah.
Anyways, the other thing about Afghanistan, of course, was there was this big blowout in the media about how they banned the media from filming the bodies that came back. And actually, just today, I was reading on CBC, someone filed an ATIP and got, like,
yeah, I think it was emails. The Citizen that did that. I remember from the I'm not sure. The way the Citizen presented it this morning was that they had filed the ATIP, but be wrong. And what it was an ATIP requesting, I guess, the responses that came into the PMO's website regarding the issue. And I guess they found that, like, you know, 9 out of 10 Canadians, like, violently, like, you know, objected to the steps taken by the...
But the point is that, okay, Stephen Harper just came out a couple weeks ago and said basically, no, I didn't say that. And Gordon O'Connor's like, what? Like, he did say that. And so basically they reversed the policy. So all along it was apparently the family's decision. And yet everyone was under this misconception, according to the PMO, that the Conservatives were actually banning the media from this. And I mean, I watched them in question period, and maybe, you know, I didn't go back and review the answers, so maybe they like framed their answers technically so that that was the case. But the very clear message was that the media were essentially banned from doing that. But they reversed that policy. They denied that they ever changed it all along. And so, you know, but anyways.
Well, regardless of, you know, what's right, I mean, it should be the family's decision. And the family should be allowed to make that decision without pressure from the media. Because those guys are scoundrels. They can be scoundrels. And they have been scoundrelly very recently, especially with these terror suspects and their family that, you know, is trying to come and go from
Why don't you set up the terrorist thing?
Well, what's the setup? I mean, honestly, everyone knows about it by now that, you know, I think it was like 19 guys were arrested in connection with a planning of a terrorist attack in Canada. It wasn't really clear exactly, you know, what the extent of it was. There was a lot of wild accusations from the media that, you know, that they were going to behead
the lawyer. It was the lawyer for the defense lawyer. For one of them.
Charges. Okay. What I am told, what I've heard, is that the actual police report mentioned there was this issue about, like, you know, beheading of the prime minister, right? The media really jumped on that one. But my understanding was that it was, in the police report, very marginal. It was just kind of, like, thrown in there some statements that said, well, you know, and this was one of the ideas that they had. But my understanding was that was early on during their sort of, like, you know, idealistic terrorism stages. When they started, like, thinking about these things more critically about, you know, what you could possibly do as a terrorist, they, I think, abandoned that very early on. And that it was never really a serious issue. And I don't think the police ever tried to insist that it was. It was just thrown into the report for the sake of completeness. But, you know, of course, obviously, like, the lawyer wanting exposure, you know, I don't know, he kind of had this, like, very sort of, like, you know, I remember watching him. He was kind of, like, this kind of sort of this expression on his face, which was sort of, you know, and to add to the, like, list of charges, the final, like, you know, most bollocks, like, charge of, you know, beheading the prime minister, you know, although, you know, he didn't actually say it, but it was sort of, like, wanting to kind of draw attention to it, and, you know, I don't even know, honestly, what, you know.
Right.
What that was all about. I mean, it was just some idea, you know, and then, of course, Harper caught a lot of criticism because he kind of blew it off. Right, because, you know, he sort of made this joke. He's like, well, you know, I can, like, tolerate terrorist, you know, threats as long as they're not coming from my own caucus, kind of thing. And there's a lot of people saying, well, you know, you're not taking it seriously, and you know, all sorts of stuff. But it's like you have to measure what is to be taken seriously. I mean, the police report, so I'm told, was clear that this was not the central issue. This was just some kind of, you know, just some little thing, and you know.
Yeah, it was probably just an off the cuff remark, but
and then having such a tongue in cheek reaction to it. I mean, it's always you know, been said down in the States after September 11th that the way to beat terrorists is not to be terrorized. Mm-hmm. So I mean, for Harper to, you know, come out and say, well, you know, I dismiss it, kind of thing. I mean, I think in this case was the right reaction.
Yeah, no, I agree fully. I didn't sense that people were criticizing.
And then of course there was the issue of blowing up the Parliament buildings.
Right.
And of course, you know, besides the, like, you know, damage to like the machinery of government and the damage to the cultural icon of the Parliament buildings, you and I both live in Centretown, so like a giant detonation would, you know, like the classic expression close to home. I mean, I don't think that that's like any closer to home than it is. I mean, there was some like rock and roll like concert on the hill last night, I think, and you know, I was out walking the dog,
yeah,
and I'm like,
Festival of the Francophonie. It was actually at City Hall, but
Was it at City Hall?
I think so. I'm pretty sure.
It's a
big stage.
But I'm walking the dog, and, like, you know, it's just like, you're just, like, hearing this reverberation from every, like, you know, building in the neighborhood. And, you know, I'm like, what is that, you know? So, I mean, it's very obvious that, like, if anything ever happened on the Hill, you know, it's definitely going to affect us, like, in a very real way.
Yeah, there won't be any podcasts. No.
No, there will be, like, special podcasts, you know. Like,
yeah, we'll break our, like, monthly, like, podcasts that, like, bring you a special update.
Like, well, I just got back from the doctors, and, you know, I just want to report about what happened. You know? But now they want to tighten Hill security and
Right. Yeah, they're talking about, like, getting rid of the street and, like, making a tunnel. But there's all this crazy stuff. But
yeah, there's a lot of crazy stuff, and I really hope that they don't, you know, go over the line. But, you know, there's also the issue of the American reaction. Now, it's, you know, basically Bush came out and said, you know, well, you know, good job, guys. You know, you foiled this plot, and that's exactly what we want to see. Now, then there was other, you know, reactions from the United States. For example, Indiana Republican Congressman John Hostetler, who had some sharp remarks for Canada. I don't know. You know, what did he say? He branded what he called South Toronto as a hotbed for Islamic extremists.
Whatever South Toronto is.
Yeah, I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, like, come on, Johnny. Like, what's South Toronto anyway? Like, Spadina? You know, like, there's a lot of immigrants in Spadina. Are they Islamic terrorists? You know, well, my experience, you know, hanging out in Chinatown has been that, no, they're mainly polite street vendors who just want to make a buck on smelly fish products, you know.
Yeah, you can get the best rotis on, in quote-unquote
South Toronto. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's just...
But there is this conception, definitely, in the United States that, like, Canada is this, you know, is harboring terrorists and, you know, a hotbed of terrorism.
Hotbed of terrorism, yeah. I know they keep using that, but...
And even after 9/11, there was this, like, misconception that just got, like, perpetuated that, like, the 9/11, you know, terrorists, some of them, like, came into the United States through Canada, which...
I think was established to not...
Yeah, it was established to be false, but...
Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, let's go over the facts.
Just wait. Just let me throw out a quote. This is my quote for, like, these types of situations. People find it easier to believe simple lies than complex truths. And Canada as a terrorist hotbed is a simple lie.
Right.
That was said by someone whose name I'm not going to pronounce.
But
French political, like, philosopher.
Let's go over the facts here. Al-Qaeda bombings in the United States, well, I don't know, technically, I mean, Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks in the United States, depending on how you want to qualify that, one really big one. Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks in Britain, one fairly... there was just the big London...
Well, there's a big one. But
the 7/7.
Okay. I thought there was another one, like... I don't know.
Perhaps you're thinking of other terrorist groups like the IRA, for example.
No, it wasn't that. It was something pertaining to...
Okay.
But,
okay. But...
And then there's Spain.
Yeah. Bombings in Madrid, you know, or whatever. Like, you know, one. Terrorist attacks in Canada from, you know, sourcing from, you know, what is being called Islamic extremism / Al-Qaeda. Zero. So, you know. Johnny, put that in your pipe and smoke it, you know.
Not to be, like, too cocky or anything.
Well, I mean, you know, look. The Americans are very passionate about defending the honor of their country. I think that it's only right that Canadians be passionate about the, you know, defending the rights of, you know, and the honor of their country. You know, I think that, you know, the CSIS, the RCMP, and the local police authorities that were involved in this did a fantastic job. I'm glad that this is going to trial so that we can sort of, you know, hopefully figure out what happened or, you know, what was going to happen. I don't think that every one of those members was going to be involved in it necessarily. I think that, you know, in a sense that it was good that they got such a large number of arrests so that they can hopefully get some people to testify against the more, you know, dangerous elements of that group. But, you know, hopefully it'll get sorted out now. There's been some questions about the treatment of the prisoners that I've seen around, you know, allegations from the lawyers about mistreatment and even so far as to say torture of the prisoners in our justice system. And so I read one article that said that apparently the prisoners were being denied sleep, that they were being woken up every half an hour, that they were forced to sleep with the lights on. And that, you know, that they were also
they were given meals and they only had like 3 minutes to eat it.
Yeah, 3 minutes to eat the meals. And so then I read a response from the Corrections Canada that said that that was completely, you know, completely false. That as far as the lights during the night, that there was little night lights in their cells, but that was standard in every prison in Ontario for security reasons. As far as being woken up every half an hour, they had no reports that actually happened, except that guards would routinely go past in the night, and that the only thing that they could account for that was that people who are not used to being in a captive environment sometimes are disturbed by that, and that the meals were they were allowed the same time as any prisoner to complete eating their meal. So it's kind of like, you know, You really have to sit down and sift through all the junk.
Right. Well, that was coming from the lawyer, and obviously his job is to, you know, to make
false accusations.
Well, to make it as worse as possible, right? He's telling one side of the story, and that's what defense lawyers do, right? Like, they're the advocate of the defendants in the court and
right.
outside of the court in the media, and so
of course
he has to make as strong as
we would have
as
to you know, sort of get into a debate about like where is the line between like a truth and a lie, or somehow some sort of like spin and just a falsehood.
Sure.
But that's yeah, but I mean it's going to be a very interesting trial. I'm going to be
right.
very interested to see what happens, but of course you probably won't hear about a lot of it because it's probably under a tight publication ban, and you know, but
yeah, we'll see. I don't know how classified it will be, but
the point is that you know, the counterterrorism efforts of the state are alive and well in Canada. If anyone was ever in doubt, hopefully this will be enough to convince them. But the next issue that comes out of that is, you know, well, what do we do in the meantime? One of the things that I've seen being talked about in the Citizen was that they wanted to have people to go into the mosques and the schools to sort of like, you know, listen in on what's being taught. That there's no, you know, sort of incitement of extremism in these venues. And they were talking about Islamic private schools. And, you know, should they have the teachers in Islamic private schools, should they have them have to be, you know, proficient in English, teach, you know, proper Canadian history, you know, have some sort of standardized curriculum in addition to the, you know, religious component that, you know, any religious private school might have. And I was kind of surprised because I thought that, you know, as it stands already, that it's the law for any school child in Canada to have to be taught, you know, certain set of, you know, certain within a certain curriculum, and that
yeah, I'm not sure how the laws work. I think there might be like a test, like a standardized test that they have to pass.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, we don't know what the law is exactly,
yeah.
But my understanding is that every child has to be proficient in one of the official languages,
right.
Or at least not be proficient, but at least be taught in that be a major component of the curriculum. And if it isn't, then it should be. Not because I'm preaching integration by any standard, you know. I mean, here's the thing, you know, you don't have to speak English. I mean, I'm not like some, you know, Dutch MP here saying that, you know, you must integrate. You know, I'm saying that, you know, you should at least know one of the official languages and be able to communicate in it. But if you don't want to, you know, when it's available for you to speak your native language, then, you know, you don't have to, kind of thing. But that for the sake of functionality in the society, you know, you should have to, as a school child, be learning one of the official languages. And it's my understanding that they have to. But if they're not, then, you know, what's going on? You know, so
right.
I don't know. It should be interesting to see. So
yeah, it would be something to watch for.
One of the big CBC stories that went on about 2 weeks ago was about this topic of integration. And they you know, one of the reporters, he went to England, Holland, and where else did he go? But of course, I'd like to throw into there a couple of other European countries, such as, you know, Germany. I've lived there. Denmark, I've been there. I have friends there. And their view of sort of the, the policy of integration of foreign cultures, in this case, Islamic values clashing with the European values. Of course, Holland is an extremely liberal, place. I mean, Amsterdam, almost anything goes.
Right.
And then, of course, that is, very highly contrary to some of the, very orthodox Muslim beliefs. And so there's a bit of a culture clash going on there. And that's resulted in a couple of very high-profile murders in Holland. Vincent van Gogh's great-nephew, who was a filmmaker who made a film about the oppression of women in Islam, and he was, obviously stabbed to death. And then Pim Fortuyn, the other Dutch prime minister, who was also killed for his beliefs. And so there's been a backlash by the Dutch, the native Dutch element that's trying to force integration. So, for example, the CBC guy, he interviewed the minister who tabled legislation to ban the burqa in public in the cities in Holland.
Right.
And this guy was saying, I think that's perfectly natural. And of course, if Canada had ever been subject to what we have been, or bombed or something like that, they would feel the same way. And I disagree. I don't think they would feel the same way at all. And I should add, if you're going to ban the burqa, you should go ahead and ban the hooded sweatshirt as well. So all the little goth kids now have to reveal their face, in public. But I mean, obviously not. This minister's point was that multiculturalism doesn't work. And there's a lot of people in Europe that feel that way now. In fact, there's actually a very fascistic, anti-Islamic, as sure as there's anti-Western elements in the Euro-Islamic culture, there's also an anti-Islamic sentiment in some of the native Europe elements, and it's very shocking. And one of the things that a lot of these guys are saying is that multiculturalism doesn't work, and it's only a matter of time until Canada will be in the same boat. And I disagree. And I mean, what better example can I give than recently? There were some Muslim schoolgirls who were sewing, Edmonton Oilers logos onto their headscarves, And so I'm like, why do you need integration? Let people integrate, from their own choosing. Instead of forcing people to take on certain characteristics, you should make it, something that they want to do, but that, obviously they don't have to do. They have to be minimally functional, but otherwise, they're free to believe what they want. And just the element of multiculturalism, despite what the Dutch minister was saying in Canada, I think is alive and well, and I think will continue to be so, because after living in Europe, I know that there is a certain sort of arrogance towards by the sort of the long-standing culture there that says this is the way you have to be, and if you're not this way, then you're weird. I mean, when I was working in Germany, I was a crazy Canadian guy, I had some, long hair, grew a goatee and everything like that. And I was just some crazy Canadian hippie, back home, I'm just Edmonton Oilers cheering me, but over there I was a little weird. But, the Germans like Canada, so I mean, that was okay. But if I was, say, Turkish, I would have been marginalized. And, I just don't think that's right. And I think that the ideal of multiculturalism should be held onto in Canada for as long as it can be.
Right. Yeah, I agree totally. Multiculturalism is really one of the strengths of Canada. And we've always been counter-assimilation.
And that the reason that Canada has a leg up over Europe is because we don't have that established elite of culture. We are all immigrants. Except for the native population, but they've, I think, demonstrated that, we can... Well, aside from what's going on in Caledonia right now, that we can all live together and
right.
sort of respect each other. So, which brings up another issue, which is why doesn't the OPP go in and bust up this, civil disturbances that are going on in Caledonia? I don't understand what's going on there. I mean, people are getting hurt. you know, I mean, there was a court injunction to go and stop that occupation, and the judge that issued that injunction said, "Why hasn't the OPP enforced my like legal, you know, decree?" And they claim that they can't.
Yeah, and I think the judge, like, I think the negotiator sat down with the judge and like explained it, and I think he like kind of changed his opinion, but. I could be.
The last I saw of it that was that the judge was calling back the OPP and the other parties, the development, the owners of the rightful owners of
right,
the development.
Which the government purchased, right? The government purchased all the land, I believe.
No, it's
government.
Right now it's a condo development owned by two, like, you know, a couple of guys that are, you know, run a.
I heard that last week. I read a paper indicating that the Ontario government had purchased the land
since the
yeah.
crisis.
Yeah.
Just to
just so that the developers aren't an interested party anymore, like, basically.
Oh, okay, I see. So, well, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, the point is that if this was a regular dispute, the OPP would have gone in and busted up long ago. I mean, you know, the police don't let riots form like this. I mean, if you go to Montreal, those guys are particularly tough. If there's anything that goes on, they're right in there with the riot gear breaking. You know, if there's any potential for there to be unrest, they're right in there and just diffusing the whole thing. I remember when Canada won the World Cup in hockey a couple years back, and I was downtown in London, and there was a giant celebration that formed on the main strip in the downtown, and I went out, and there was like thousands of people in the street, and we were marching along and just cheering, and it was a real, you know. Just a real moment, and the London police just rolled right in and busted us all up and sent us all home. You know, I mean, they can do that, but in this case they are not, and they are claiming that they can't, and I don't understand how they get off saying that they can't dispel like tense situations like this.
It's obvious that it's like a political situation more than,
well, it's obvious to us, but they won't say it.
Well, of course, they but they can't come out and say that.
Yeah, so. You know, the issue with Iperwash, and, you know, Dalton McGuinty doesn't want to be in the same hot water that Mike Harris was. And so I kind of am fearful that inaction will lead to the same destination that the Iperwash action did. You know,
right.
that what happened will, you know, and then the other issue was...
Which was if you believe the official story from Mike Harris, was inaction. I mean, he basically says that he didn't say anything. Like,
yeah. Or, well, that the police, you know, had too much, you know, that they were too aggressive. Mm-hmm. Right now, they're trying to hang back. But, you know, people are getting hurt. I mean, what's going to happen when someone dies, you know, is what I want to know. Will they, like, finally... I mean, does it take someone to have to die for them to want to do something? One of the chiefs, or one of the heads of the Ontario Police Union basically said that, you know, he called it a... okay. Carl Walsh, president of the Ontario Provincial Police Association, said that regarding Caledonia, we're caught in the middle of it. We're supposed to be the law enforcers, and somehow we've ended up as a United Nations peacekeeping mission. You know, I got to disagree with it. This is not the United Nations. You do have a mandate. This is your country. This is your province. You have the authority to dispel dangerous situations as that they're happening. This is not, I'm going into some foreign country and nobody's, you know, taking me seriously because they don't recognize my authority in this particular case, and I don't have the mandate to use force when it is necessary to keep people from killing each other. This is just the wrong example. Just, you know, like, and then the last issue is apparently during one of the flare-ups, what some places have, some media sources have described as a police vehicle was basically hijacked by the native protesters. It turns out that apparently that vehicle was from the U.S. Border Services. And my question is, what is the U.S. Border Services doing roaming around the Ontario countryside? And furthermore, what are they doing so close to a domestic, you know, situation that they're so physically close that they actually became involved when their police car was stolen? And who gave them authority to be there, and why were they there? I want to know, but so far I haven't been able to figure that out. you know, they have no right to be involved in these situations. I mean, maybe they're concerned about, like, you know, trouble going on in proximity to the border. But, I mean, if the OPP granted them permission to be, roaming around outside of their mandate, outside of their jurisdiction, why were they there? I want to know. If you can tell me, like, let me know, please.
Don't point at me. I don't know.
I'm talking to the listeners, you know. So.
Yeah. Anyways, let's change the subject. We have a new feature for you. Question Period Jeopardy! Where we play an answer and you have to guess the question.
Mr. Speaker, I thank my honorable colleague for his question. Clearly, he's referring to the first 100 days of this government. It's too easy to say that we've settled the UNESCO issue, which went on for years. We've also settled the matter in the Quebec City area. We've worked very hard with the Federalist government in place in Quebec City, and we have an excellent agreement with that government. We've not only settled that problem, but we've also settled the softwood lumber problem, which lasted for so long with the party opposite. Wait another 100 days and you'll see some real accomplishments.
I'm your host, Alex Trebek. You just heard an answer to a question. Now, can you tell me what the question was? Was it A, when will the government realize that the Quebec lumber industry thinks that this is a bad deal for Quebec? Number 2, when will the minister keep his campaign promise to move the museum from Ottawa to Gatineau? Number 3, when will the government allow Quebec to have a seat at the table of other international panels, not just a showpiece at UNESCO? And finally, number 4, the minister has been sitting on his hand for the last 100 days. When will the minister table the results in the House? Time's up. Here's the question.
Will the Minister of Transport use his influence in Cabinet to promote the move of the Science and Tech Museum to Gatineau as he committed, yes or no?
Well, that's our show for the week, month, year. You decide, or rather, we'll decide, and we'll be back hopefully shortly, but
no guarantees.
Days of summer might keep us away from the podcast. Anyways, I hope you enjoyed the show.
Yeah, and Parliament is shutting down right this week, I guess, after this week. So, you know, things will be slowing down for a while, but that won't stop us from offering our 2 cents worth. So, everybody take care. Music by La Mundial. Check them out online, lamundial.net.
Thank you. Have a good week.
Month or year. So this is not Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals. No one of them. Joe, Mr. Speaker, not money from the kids. Gonna strike just same for mine. Mm-hmm.